good afternoon, and I'd like to thank the organizers again also for the invitation and for the Perimeter Institute to the Perimeter Institute for the wonderful accommodations that we've had for the past 2 or 3 days now. So today I'll be talking about a research program that was initiated very recently, just as recently as 2 years ago, which can be described as an effort really to bring self force to the numerical relativity community. I list down here the people who are involved in this effort, although of course I take full responsibility for any inaccuracies or gross misrepresentations that may arise in my talk. The plan of the talk is as follows. I'll provide a little bit of background. Much of it will be unnecessary to those who have been participating in CAPRA for the longest time, and explain the basic method that we're proposing. I will then go into the test results that have been achieved so far in the past 2 years, and then after that I'll go summarizing what has been learned about in CAPRA in this year's CAPRA that are directly related or relevant to this approach that we're pursuing, and finally I'll summarize with prospects and the challenges that remain in this research program. So. So again, background, this first slide is probably unwarranted given the audience that I have, but I like putting it here because as a reminder of why cell force or radiation reaction is of contemporary interest, and that is, of course, that we want to achieve, or we want to be able to compute gravitational waves for a particular class of systems, and this is the extreme mass ratio in spiral. And we've heard a lot of good results that have arisen from just calculating the gravitational cell force and looking how this affects specific systems, but we really haven't broached the issue of how we are able, we are going to use this information that we now have, or the knowledge that we've now gained over the past few years, to actually compute some of the gravitational waves that we believe that we expect from extreme mass spatial wind spirals. And I emphasize this because a necessary step in taking us from what we know now to these gravitational wave calculations will be to actually use the cell force we're computing and updating our simulations to actually produce gravitational waves. And at this point, we don't really know how to do that. I mean, most of the ideas that we've heard involve some kind of post-processing, and this is really what is one of the key motivations of the 3+1 approach. So, cell force. Okay, and I really like this slide because it illustrates at the heart of all cell force calculations is a really very simple idea. And this is really something that I like using. And because it illustrates all the necessary steps in the cell force calculation. So consider a very simple elementary problem involving, putting a charge right next to an infinite conducting plane. So imagine, for example, a charge Q there. Now we obviously everybody knows how to perform this calculation, and this is basically what I've outlined here. But I want to point out the specific steps that are involved just to make clear that this is exactly what transpires in any kind of cell force calculation. Well, the most convenient way of doing this, of course, is by thinking about an image charge that it's actually induces or can be described as producing the field that actually is in the physical domain that we're interested in, which is this region. So this is the real charge. This is the image charge here. By considering the field due to the two, we actually know the full field in the physical domain, one of which is going to be divergent where the actual charge is. Right? So this is going to be the potential. This is going to be the full physical field in the actual domain we're interested in, and one of which is going to be divergent, which is this piece. Now, if I ask you the question, what is the force you need to actually use to keep that charge in place? Right, then we know what the answer is as well. We simply, ignore the field that comes from, or the Coulomb field that comes from the actual charge. And when we compute the force that we need to exert, which is really the cell force, we don't include that Coulomb field. We implicitly simply remove it from the physical field, and then we're left with a regular field that we then say is the correct answer. Okay, that is all there is in a cell force calculation. It involves first identifying the piece that does not cause a force on the charge, and then subtracting it from a physical field that we presumably can compute. So those are the two elements. okay? It just made technically more difficult in more interesting cases. All right, so now we've heard quite a bit about this from Lior's excellent talk this morning, but I'll say a little bit about it just to emphasize the differences. And again, I apologize for not talking about all the approaches because it's my talk is really geared towards explaining the 3+1 approach. Most of the interesting, useful calculations to date have been done in what I consider to be the standard approach. And the standard approach can be described as, with the following phrase, which is basically where you evolve something first and then regularize later. So you evolve something that is formally divergent, and then you regularize that to somehow get the force that you actually want. And this is, if I were to refer back to this, it's as if you were really trying to solve first for the divergent physical field, and then trying to regularize it somehow by computing a singular field that you're then going to subtract. That's a standard approach. Of course, the specific steps that go into it involve, computing the divergent retarded field by a variety of methods, or whatever method is your favorite. There have been a bunch of frequency domain calculations. There have also been a few 1+1 time domain calculations, but all of this are aimed at computing the retarded field, which without regularization is going to be divergent. Then the next step is going to be to somehow remove the divergence from that retarded field, and that involves, in most of the useful calculations that have been done, computing these so-called regularization parameters, which really capture this divergence I'm talking about. Now, in the 3+1 approach is simply a reversal of that calculational procedure. Instead, what we do is regularize first, and then use whatever evolution code that you want to evolve some field that will no longer need regularization afterwards. So here, the approach then is to work with an explicitly regular effective point particle source in the gravitational case, at least, and then to compute for a regularized field and the corresponding cell force with a 3+1 code that presumably exists already within the numerical relativity community. So that's the basic idea. Now, so let me just go and explaining further how this method can actually, what the foundations are behind this method. So the key idea behind this is really what is now known as the Detweiler-Whiting decomposition of the retarded field, which involves the split of the physical retarded field into two well-defined pieces, one of which has been identified to be entirely responsible for the cell force, and one divergent piece, which is the thing that you really need to subtract. Okay? It was their work that really, their work that we're using here. And so in this case, then, what is clear that is that when you want to solve for a cell force, the goal would be to solve for this regular field psi r. Now, it's important to note that psi s is something that's quite well defined. There's a Green's function decomposition for it. You can approximate it with whatever method that you want. And so therefore, we can do have an analytic way of describing it. Okay? And that's a crucial point. So how do we then use this idea to pursue this 3+1 approach that I'm talking about? Well, the idea is to first split up, this is now the practical situation, to first split up your retarded field into some psi r, and something which is going to involve what we call a window function, and an approximation to the full Detweiler-Whiting singular field. And I need to emphasize that there's a tilde here because, we can never really get access to the full singular field. We can only approximate it somewhat. So we compute this analytically. We have a nice, not necessarily nice, but an expression for the singular field anyway. We use that. We multiply it by some window function, which at this point is completely arbitrary. And I'll describe some constraints on it in a later slide. And then we simply do this split. Okay. An example of a singular field approximation is provided by, is provided in very convenient form in THZ coordinates. And in THZ coordinates, which is a special locally inertial frame, it actually looks quite simple. It becomes simply q over rho up to order rho cube terms, which is quite nice. And so so that's just an example. And so basically what we do with that is the following. Well, go back to the actual wave equation that we would normally solve if you were interested in the physical retarded field. And then what we do is simply, again, with this split, we move what we know analytically to the source side of the equation, right? And if we have done our job well enough and actually have, you know, computed or approximated the singular field well enough, what you'll end up with is a right-hand side, which we call an effective source, that does not contain a delta function at all. It will, of course, be a finite differentiability, but we have been made to understand that this is not a problem for numerical relativists. So, you know, at the end of the day, then you end up with a wave equation for some field, which is being sourced by an effective source, which is completely calculable, and it's regular where the charge is. So this is the starting point. Okay. So the prescription then for a fully self-consistent evolution, for a point charge in a curved background space-time, is as follows. You take your regularized wave equation. You know, you have, we provide you an effective source, and then you simply take your favorite 3 plus 1 code, you solve this equation while simultaneously updating the charge that you have by feeding in whatever results from this to compute the self force and then driving the point particle dynamics at the same time. So this is, you know, this is the scheme. This basic set of equations, the PDE-ODE system, that presumably is not going to be impossible, right? And so it only requires the following things. Code that efficiently evaluates SF, we can provide that. And at the end of the talk, I'll show you that, in fact, we do have that there have been developments in this recent cat that actually compute that for a variety of situations. We need a good 3 plus 1 code for solving the wave equation and, well, a trivial ODE solver, which is, you know, something that anybody can just write. And so that's the scheme. All right. Now, a couple of comments. Again, I probably said enough about this already. This tilde S that we analytically compute cannot be the exact singular field, or in general circumstances is not the exact singular field. And so therefore, your effective source is always going to be a finite differentiability. And that might be of consequence in the numerics. This window function that I have yet unspecified is really something that you choose, and you choose such that it satisfies the following conditions. And these conditions are chosen to guarantee essentially that whatever you evolve, if you take the gradient of whatever that thing is, when evaluated at the location of the point charge, gives the self force will then push the charge, right? And that this and that field as well, when evaluated in the wave zone, actually gives you the fluxes that you would be interested in for gravitational waves. And so that's the basic scheme. All right. So pros and cons, and most of these is probably going to be obvious already. Again, one is that the natural output of this approach is self-consistent evolution. Okay, if you can do all the steps that I've just said, then you know what all you really have to do is simultaneously evolve these two equations in time, and you know if you evaluate the field that you're evolving at the wave zone, that's already going to give you fluxes that have been presumably corrected by the self force. Now, this approach also does not rely on any inherent symmetries in your background space-time. So if you can do it for Schwarzschild, there is really no fundamental difference in any difficulty at all in getting from Schwarzschild to Kerr. So I mean, that's an important selling point. And finally, these other things are separated because they're just some features that are, you know, that are just nice. And I think I might have repeated some of them already. Now, why not 3 plus 1? Well, from our experience, I mean, and this is probably not, this is probably something obvious. Well, we invariably get lesser results, results with lesser accuracy compared to the more sophisticated methods out there. And in fact, that's something that's a challenge that remains for us. And then, of course, it inherits all the difficulties of any 3 plus 1 calculation. Of course, okay, so we have this idea. What we want to do is test this on some simple cases. Now, the very first, the easiest non-trivial self-force calculation that you can possibly think of that has probably been done by every, you know, person in the self-force community is this problem, which is that of, you know, a scalar charge is moving in a circular orbit around a Schwarzschild geometry. It is non-trivial because you can't really do it analytically. This actually does require some numerics, and we do have very, very accurate frequency domain results that we can then compare to. So let me just explain, just summarize what this problem is. I described the physical situation. But because of the symmetries of that problem, it turns out that there are only two independent components that needs to be solved for here. the time component and the r component, and of course, the theta component there because of the reflection symmetry, is going to be zero. And because of the helical symmetry that's inherent in this problem, once you know what the time component is, you automatically get the phi component of the south force as well. So again, I may be forgotten, but this is nothing but the gradient of the regular field that we're going to be solving for. In this problem, there's also a tight relationship between the flux, the scalar energy flux, and the local calculation of the south force, which can be a good diagnostic for our demerits. So this is why this is also a good problem to just test methods and our methods and our tools. So the very first attempt, a test of our idea was rather awkward in the sense that it went back to what it was not supposed to be meant for. It was implemented in 1 plus 1. So and the reason we did this was simply to provide a test of principle, and we did this because it was easy enough that I could write everything, and we could then use this to convince numerical relativists to actually help us, right? And that's a good thing that we have. So the idea here was to simply write our own 1 plus 1 code. We had the effective source at our disposal. We found the spherical harmonic components of our effective source at every r. We fed this into our 1 plus 1 evolver, and then we just solved this for a variety of LM modes. That we reconstitute it in the same way that the mode sum scheme is performed, and then we compute the south force. We could also compute the fluxes, and these are the results that we had. We achieved south force accuracies within 1%, and then we achieved we matched the retarded field in the wave zone to a relative error that was really, really quite small. And with this, we were quite satisfied enough. And then we ventured out into the world and said, okay, can you guys help us? And so we did. And we got we enlisted the help of two very nice numerical relativists who had, codes lying around, just to solve the wave equation that we were providing them. And so this is a very sparse, this is intentionally a very sparse slide because I can't really say much about the details of those codes that were used. And if you had any questions, you can simply refer to these two papers to describe them, or you can refer to Peter Diener, who's now in the audience. So we have this wave equation. We use their codes to solve it, and here are some of the results. Before we get to that, this is just to give you an indication of what we were dealing with here. This is what the effective source looks like. It's plotted along the equatorial plane, where the charge is actually sitting at, x equals 10 and y equals 0 in Kerr-Shield coordinates. And this is for a Schwarzschild case, as I said. That's essentially what it is. And the key thing that you have to notice here is that you see really that C0, the directional dependence of the limit of the gradient of the the C0 nature of the effective source at the location of charge, which is right here. Okay, and again, and I think I might not have mentioned this, but the source, except for that single point, is actually smooth everywhere else. The charge in the other.
It's an x equals 10 and a y equals 0. It's right here. You don't really see it. All these funny features that you see are really just artifacts of the window function that we use. Okay, but this
structure that you see here is somewhat not quite visible in this plot. It's just zoomed out. It's just so tiny. That's actually a challenge. It turns out that that's really the numerical challenge here: how to resolve that area. Okay. Enough of that. The window function that was used to produce that. Made use of a transition function that was first introduced in this paper by Nico, Wolfgang, Ben Owen, and Werner Brugmann back in 2006. It's a weird looking function that has this nice property that's actually smooth everywhere, and it transitions from 0 to 1. And so basically with that we reconstruct a window function based on it. It's like two versions of it. One is just a reflected version of the other. And it depends on 8 parameters that we can then fiddle with to actually achieve the best results. And this is something that we were using like really high order Gaussians, which didn't really produce very good results. But when we switched to this for the right set of parameters, we achieved a quite good result. We were happy. And so let's go to results from this. So here what you're seeing is a plot of the dissipative piece of the cell force in this problem, which is Ft. So the, and I emphasize that this is a local calculation. The blue line here is, of course, what you would expect from a frequency domain calculation. So it's just constant because you're essentially you're following the charge and you're evaluating it there. And because of the helical symmetry, you're not supposed to be you're not supposed to see any changes. Of course, here when we set up the problem, we don't start with the correct initial data. And so there's going to be a bunch of junk which we wait for to propagate out of our computational domain, and we see that from both codes. So the red plot here is what comes from Peter's finite difference in code, and the green one here is what arises from the spectral code that Wolfgang has. So you see a bunch of features. I mean, but the point of that I need to emphasize here is that, I mean, although this looks a bit noisy, the noise is actually quite small. You just notice what the scale is here. It's very, very tiny. And the oscillations that you see are mainly due, in at least in the multi-block case, are mainly arise because, well, this low frequency, the lower frequency oscillations arise because it's crossing multi-patch boundaries. And this the higher frequency elements arise because the charge is actually crossing grid points. And so you see, you know, all these features here. But the good thing is that, you know, it basically settles down to where we expect, which is, you know, quite close to what we want the correct what we want the answer to be, which is the correct answer, which is the blue line. And it does so, you know, after 600 m. Going now to the conservative piece, we have not so good, I mean, not as good results, but, you know, good enough for us at least as a first test. So here again, you're seeing essentially the same thing. The blue line represents what the correct answer ought to be, and there are three other data, time series here. Two coming from the multi-block code at different resolutions, and one from the spectral code, which is the green line. And so here we just basically show the reason why we present this two plots from the multi-block code is to demonstrate that this is actually a convergent code, and it's converging. And with further tests, you actually see that this is second order convergent. But we basically were satisfied with the level that was achieved here already. And so, again, so you know, it reaches accuracy that we were happy with, at least as a test of principle. Then we also went further on to actually compute the energy flux from this. And there's, again, as I've shown you, there is a nice, clean, and tight relationship between the energy flux and the local cell force calculation. And so here, this is really the energy flux. This is really a surface integral over a two-sphere at a certain radius. And this was done all with the multi-block code. So what you're seeing here are the results of the energy flux for different locations of the outer boundary. Of the extraction radius rather. So here you have R, you put the extraction radius R equals 50, you get something that's not quite good, but the further and further out you go, you get improvements. And using basically all this data, you can then extrapolate to, you know, what would be, you know, the scalar energy flux if your extraction radius was actually at infinity. And you see here that the blue line, which is the extrapolation to R equals infinity, is really, really quite close to what we would really want, which is the correct answer, which is the correct FP. So by the way, this is the energy here has been rescaled so that it can actually be compared to the local cell force. So, again, so that's the reason why we're actually showing them in the same plots. And so, I mean, like I said, based on these preliminary tests, we were quite happy with what we see. So this is just some more detailed information about the results that we got. We are not quite getting, so I guess the important thing to take note of are the errors that we achieve relative to the frequency domain results that are out there. They're not quite what we would want, but again, we were quite happy with it because we were already getting around 2 to 3 decimal places of accuracy. At the end of the day, we really want to push this to 5 or 6 decimal places of accuracy, and we are made to believe that this is actually quite possible. So this was from last year. Now this year's CAPRA actually brought about some important progress for this whole research program to proceed, and is actually, I mean, I would like to summarize them in as two things. The previous plots or the previous results that I showed you were exclusively for the case of a scalar charge moving in a circular orbit around Schwarzschild, because that was the only effective source we could compute at the time. Right. As of today, two independent works by Barry Wardell and myself, which are both based on this description of the singular field by Roland Haas and Eric Poisson, has allowed us now to compute the effective source for a scalar charge that goes in a generic geodesic of a Schwarzschild background. So here I just present you can ask me what it means maybe at the end of the talk, but this was essentially the starting point of both of us to achieve an effective source that kind of looks like the plot that I showed you before anyway, because this is really also for a circular orbit, for a scalar charge in a circular orbit, but it's now computed with a generic code. I mean, we could have plugged in any four velocity, describes the geodesic in question, and we would have been able to produce a plot like this. So we now have an effective scalar source for generic orbits in Schwarzschild, and I think we also have it for Curve.
Geodesic orbits?
We don't have that yet, but that's certainly within reach based on the techniques that were used to actually compute this. I mean, this formalism here is in no way restricted to geodesic orbits. So this is certainly within reach. Another nice development was something that was reported by Peter Diener, which kind of addressed this important problem that arose in our initial tests with the previous codes that we were working with. And this problem was basically the impact of spurious reflection from the outer boundary. I mean, the cell force is inherently very, very, very small, and so therefore, despite the fact that Peter already took very good care of boundary conditions at the outer boundary,
we were still getting this big bump in the local cell force calculation because at some point that external boundary would be in causal contact with the charge that we were looking at. This has been solved, to some degree, to a very good degree, I would say, by making use of this idea by Deginoglu and Tilio. I mean, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, really, but when the idea here is to compactify essentially the radial direction, the radial direction in your space-time, and to transform the time coordinates of spatial slices asymptotes to scribe plus instead of spatial infinity, and Peter has now implemented this in his code, and it seems to be to provide a good strategy for outer boundary reflection. And so let me just present one of the slides that he showed us 2 days ago, which is quite impressive and got quite a bit of attention. And so here what we are shown is basically a plot of the energy flux as a function of time. So the rather noisy data that you see is actually the original data that was used to produce this. It looks very clean here simply because of the scales, right? So I mean, if you compare the y-axis here and compare it to what I'm showing you here, this is more than a 10 time magnification of more than 10 times here. So this is where you actually see all the spikes here. So basically the idea here, I mean, to get these other things, these are all extrapolations to r equals infinity by making use of, and the 3 here, 3, 4, 5, 6 here means that he's using 3 data points, 4 data points, and 5 data points. So basically, for example, in the purple line, this was computed by extrapolating to r equals infinity using three outer boundaries. I mean, yeah, so 3 different outer boundaries to get that point. Whereas the red one, I mean, so the very good one, did not require any extrapolation. This really was a computation of the energy flux at scribe plus. So you see that there's a drastic improvement. They don't look, they're qualitatively different because he tried out a different thing as well here, where in this nicer result, he actually he turned on the initial data smoothly, and so you get a larger bump at the beginning. But at the end of the day, you don't get this bounce, and you're able to actually evolve it for a much longer time, and it eventually settles down without extrapolation to within very, very close of the correct answer. And so we were quite happy with that because it sort of it actually kind of fixes the problem that we were worried about before. And so, looking ahead then, with all these developments in place, we do have
you know, I can confidently say that you know, within the next paper we'll probably be able to, no, not probably, we will be able to produce the first self-consistent evolution for a scalar charge in a curved vector. Whether or not it'd be accurate enough to be believable is a different question, but we can definitely produce something now. We do still need strategies to handle the fact that the effective source we're using is not smooth, it's actually C0. Okay, and we'd be glad to hear your ideas about them so that we can implement them. In order to actually reduce the noise in the local self-force calculation that would then be used to actually update the orbits. I think it's also time, since you know we have all these key developments in place that can be used for the scalar case, it's probably the right time now to actually begin thinking about how to extend this whole research program into, you know, what's really interesting, which is gravity. And there are a couple of, you know, a couple of pieces that are still missing. We can definitely, with the same techniques that were used to compute the effective scalar source for a scalar charge, also produce an effective source for a point mass. I think it's going to be pretty straightforward. The issue then is going to be, okay, what do we do with it? Okay, the most naive thing would be to simply, you know, start out. You know, the most naive thing would be to simply start out with the linearized Einstein equations in Lorentz gauge, which is formally most similar to the scalar wave equation that we began with. Of course, this will then entail a 3+1 evolution code that solves that instead of just a scalar wave equation. And then finally, this is the thing that's most unclear. We probably need we definitely need a better, or not better because there doesn't exist anything at the moment, a clear prescription of actually what to do with the gauge condition that will have to be dealt with in the gravitational case. And that's something that we haven't been talking about in the past couple of days. And so with that, I would like to just summarize and say, well, there does exist a 3+1 approach to the self-force program. Our initial tests, at least to us, indicate that this is a promising approach. I can again confidently say that we are well in position to performing fully consistent evolution, at least for the scalar charge. And even in that context, from a purely numerical point of view, the real problem really is that of reducing the noise in the self-force calculation for us to actually be able to update the position or the dynamics of the point charge accurately. And finally, this last point is, you know, for us to be able to get anything interesting for gravity from this approach, we really need to start thinking about, well, how to extend this to that case. Thank you for your attention.
So we have quite a bit of time for questions, and we'll start our coffee break a bit early. Turn here, Sam.
So what did you mean by what don't we have with the gauge condition?
So I don't know what to do. So we have this set of equations. So okay, the naive thing would be to take, you know, whatever code we produce for the effective source for point mass that we get from, you know, the singular field in Lorentz gauge. Right, and then I can give that to somebody who, say, has a 3+1 code that solves the linearized Einstein equations, or the Lorentz gauge equations. Then, do we then just use the self-force? I mean, do we then just use the gravitational self-force computed there to update the particle orbit? And what do we do with the fact that, you know, for that equation to actually be sensible, the divergence of the perturbation has to be small? So
this has nothing to do with numerical. You're just taking issue with
I don't know how
equations.
Yes, it's not clear how to proceed. I think in the way the type of the 1+1 calculation has done this was by trying to keep the divergence small, but without making it completely go to zero. And
we sent it to zero. We include this equation terms.
Right.
We sent it to zero, but we weren't worried about the evolution.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Okay. So, but you're accepting that you want some small but non-zero violation of the gauge condition.
Right.
Finally, so you just don't have to do that numerically.
Well, I think there should be prescriptions to do that. I just don't know if that's the right way. So, suppose for example we did that, and do we simply use the self-force we compute there to update the?
Well, I would say yes, but I'm just trying to understand whether your claim is numerical or.
No, it's fundamental. I just don't know.
Oh, okay. Well, I wanted to take a poll yesterday, but I said
okay.
Yes, and
Sure. Yes, to what? Could you be specific?
That you can solve the equation of the gauge condition violating the given variance was what we proposed. I mean, not proposed, but we already formed from the X-Men region.
So I'm going to disagree with you, Ian. So I don't think the issue is foundational nor fundamental. I think the issue is practical. And it arises because if you just try, and I'm picking Leor's word for it, I mean, if you try to just solve the wave equation in linear gravity, you typically, because you're dealing with a bunch of coupled functions, you generally generate a lot of instability at a level of solving the equations numerically that you can tame by incorporating the Lorentz gauge condition within your evolution equations, thinking that the correct thing to do is to drive the divergence of the perturbation to zero, that is, enforce the Lorentz gauge condition strictly. There might be other ways of curing the instabilities without resorting to the gauge condition, or it might be that you could still cure the instabilities by enforcing the correct statement of the relaxed version of the Lorentz gauge condition. But I see that all as being rather, practical issues that need to be resolved so that the numerical implementation will be successful.
So the instability you talk about is this growth in the divergence of H bar?
No, I mean the unstable modes that you get if you don't try to.
That's one, but secondly, you do want to make sure that the gauge condition is satisfied. You're not satisfying it on your initial slides.
Well, satisfied to be appropriate for relaxed formulation.
Yes, okay.
So that's the whole point about the relaxation scheme. It's always driving it towards zero, but it never gets there. It's always being fed by numerical instability. And so thankfully, it's never exactly at zero. It always allows some slop. It's just enough to get by.
Well, I think there's a danger if you try to drive it to zero, but the correct answer is above the numerical error that, that you can't beat. So I think,
the correct.
So there is a desired value that you should, that you should achieve with the numerical evolution. If you have a scheme that tries to drive it beyond that, you're going to create all sorts of internal tensions.
No, I think that's what you want to do. So the correct value, if the instability, so if it's fed by instability that makes it sit above the level of numerical error, then you can't evolve.
Well, okay, so if this is where you want to be and you can drive it up to here, okay, you can't do any better than that. If this is where you want to be, but you're successful at driving it down below, then you're internally inconsistent.
But I'd say numerical error will always pop you back up.
I don't know.
Why don't we go ahead to other questions if there are any?
Yeah. I have an observation on this last point. Historically, in other numerical relativity problems, they had problems with gauge condition violations growing over time. Gauge damping was essential to getting things to work for a reasonably long time evolution. How we did it here is not clear.
But the difference here is that here we want the gauge to be slightly violated. That's the difference between this, which is fundamentally different from other problems. You want to keep it violated, but if you do impose like a gauge damping mechanism and put it in place, then you don't want it to actually drive the gauge violation to zero. You just want to keep it somewhere.
Right. Well, indeed. When you impose a gauge damping thing, you design the gauge damping term so that if the condition is satisfied exactly, the term vanishes, so you're not mucking up your equations. Whereas here, you want to keep it a slight violation of the gauge without mucking up the equations. So it's much harder to design a damping scheme which, by muck up, I mean yield a different solution than the true one. It's much harder to design a damping scheme. This is not something you can just throw in the computer.
This is what people would consider a practical issue. But from my point of view, I think that's a lack of understanding on my point, so I consider it fundamental to me.
Question. So, I think that's a matter of, do you know what is the violation or not?
I'm sorry?
So do you know what the evaluation or do you not? Because so
no.
I think that the practical implementation is this one. I mean driving the gauge to zero. And so you can think about what is already detected in the cloud, but there is already the expression for the violation of the gauge. So you can just do the same method, putting this into the condition.
And it's not very different from doing generalized harmonic.
There's no analytic expression for how much the violation ought to be.
They just prove its order in the square or something, but that's
no,
exactly.
You can actually write down a formal expression involving an integral over Green's function.
Yeah.
You might turn that into another wave equation that would, you know, it would be more practical for us, but I think that's...
All of you squared or mu? What is it? You know? Violation.
Well, it's the next order.
It's the next order making. I think we're in agreement that we don't quite know what to do with the gauge.
We know what equation to solve.
Oh, yeah. We know what the equation to do, so yes, but we just don't know what happened.
But you have to get to this precision, because it's very small. And yeah, it's still very far from this.
Next half. Or next half. I'm just promising scalars. next half. We ought to talk about that.
Well, I had a question. We were talking here and then yesterday on areas that came from not using the exact full singular thing. So yesterday you were talking about the error from that by looking at the singular field on the inside that you're losing out. You could also phrase it by saying that you're using the exact, that if you use the exact singular field, you're zero on the inside, but in the place where the window function is non-zero, you're not quite using the exact singular field. And the question is, so if you phrase it in that way, can you say, I'm just wondering, what happens if you move the window function out, you presumably reduce that error, but something else found that goes wrong.
So it's unclear. Yeah, it's unclear to me too what errors that truncation will actually induce, and because I'm unclear about that in the general case. So whether pushing the window function boundary away is again not clear to me as well. But the point that I was trying to if you're looking for an assessment of what the errors are going to be like. As you push the window function out, I don't have a good understanding of that. But I was claiming yesterday that it's not expected to be zero.
You've got something that grows about something. Other questions? Okay, so why don't we start our coffee early? We have a discussion section scheduled back here at 4:30.